So, Putt Dog, I recently came across this. It looks something like an ancient songbook. I can't read it, though. It's in Orzhet. You mind giving it a look over? Thanks, Chummer. The title says, what? The Ballads of Scratch the Orc? Well, get back to me when you get done with the thing. I'm curious. Coming to you straight from the most reliably biased source on the Matrix, broadcasting as a proud member of the Shadowcasters Network, I am Opti. Welcome to the Neo-Anarchist Podcast. We are back with the update of how things got to be where they are now, and we're making progress again. It appears that Neonet was too busy with their own problems to give me any blowback on that last Corp episode, so I may just have to do another. And another. But first, we're going to start off episode 80 the way we always do, with our Dear Opti segment. First question is from Jules Watts. Dear Opti, if you could work with any musician, who would it be, and why? Man, what a good question. If I had my all-time choice, it would have to be Shieldwall, but especially when Frumius was part of the band. After he left, it just wasn't the same. Still, great band, but I'd like to track Frumius down one day, assuming he'd let himself be found, and jam together for sure. What about you, Crows? Who would you like to jam with? Maria Mercurial? Jet Black? Tolson Twins? The Angry Badgers? The Fraggin' Unicorns? Let me know. Next up, Joel Kramer asks, Dear Opti, say you've come across the body of a geeked enemy Decker with a bleeding-edge cyberdeck locked up in his cranium. Assuming you can get away with the extraction, would you choose to fence it or keep your hands clean? Well, Joel, that's another good question. I don't share the aversion that some have to grabbing things off dead folks. I mean, dead is dead. They're not missing it. There's nothing powerful enough to raise the dead without a dark spirit, and anyone who's powerful enough to do it wouldn't need the body intact. So I say, take the deck, do good with it, and your hands are still clean. This next one comes from K-Town Patriot. He says, Dear Opti, would you consider a geographical segment on sprawls around the world? Why, yes, Chummer, I would. I'm planning those episodes all the time. What sort of locations would you crows like to see? I'm already planning one on the Redmond Barrens, and I'll probably do some other Seattle and Chicago locations. But others? I don't know. Let me know. And our last question is this. Dear Opti, should I trust Stuffer Shack soybean burritos? From a very cautious Street Sam. Well, cautious, here's the honest-to-ghost truth. Stuffer Shack is an Azzy Corp, so no, don't trust it. But, on the other hand, you have to eat something, and it's not like good, wholesome, fair trade organic food is hopping onto your plate now, is it? That dreck hasn't been available for over 3 decades, so you eat what you can when you can. That's how I see it. Still, it is a convenience store burrito, and I almost never eat anything that cooks at a convenience store. I hope that helps. Keep those questions coming in. You can get them to me on Face Matrix or shoot me a message at opti@neo-anarchist.com, and I will make your lives enhanced by answering them. And now, strap in as we go back to the past and talk about 2071. The main story of 2071 is the ghost cartels, and I can't unravel that story from the world news, so I'll get into the events surrounding the drug Tempo, and once that's done, I'll revisit the geopolitical news that doesn't concern Tempo. Back in the day, when Aztechnology or Oro Corporation swallowed up all the big drug cartels, there were a few that managed to avoid being assimilated. The Olaya cartel, the Andes cartel, and the Morales cartel, and a bunch of other smaller cartels, ended up running to what became Amazonia, and helped the fledgling state find its feet. Since, they have stayed on the edge of Amazonia, trying to stay below the radar of both Amazonia and Aztlán. That's why they're called ghost cartels. But by 2071, these ghost cartels were sick of being beat at the drug game by the Yakuza, Mafia, and the Vori. They pooled their resources and worked nonstop to come up with a bioengineered awakened drug to help put them back on top. So when the Olaya cartel was approached by a mysterious group offering a new drug and a means to produce it, the ghost cartels jumped at the chance. The ghost cartels opened up production labs in Bogota, among other places, and made robust preparations to flood the drug market with the new drug that became known as Tempo. Tempo had the effect of giving the user a euphoric high, at least initially. Afterwards, Tempo tapped the user into astral space, allowing them to feel the emotional energy of others and increasing their own empathy towards others. Further, Tempo produces hallucinations while making the user somewhat disoriented and suggestible. Lastly, Tempo can make the user feel invulnerable, leading many Tempo users to take greater risks and attempt dangerous feats. The side effects of addiction to Tempo include loss of appetite, apathy, depression, schizophrenia, insomnia, psychosis, loss of ability to feel pleasure, and severe weight loss. Those who have used tempo for any length of time begin to experience fugue states, trances, and personality shifts ranging from small to intense. There's more to tempo, but I'll talk about that in a little bit. By February, the Olaya cartel had built up enough stock of tempo that they began to offer samples of it in key markets such as Seattle, Miami, Los Angeles, Hong Kong, and Neo-Tokyo. They edged out larger cartels and focused on more independent dealers, eventually going with the Kumon Go in Seattle, the Black Chrysanthemums in Hong Kong, the Koshari in Los Angeles, with similar low-profile gangs in other cities. They were ordered to distribute to high-profile clients and build their own networks. The Kumon Go syndicate pulls Seattle's First Nation gangs into their fold, encouraging them to build their own network, keeping the Kumon Go's support secret. Initially pushed at nightclubs, raves, and universities, tempo quickly hit the streets and became readily available. By spring, the major cartels and syndicates have taken notice of tempo, but remained unconcerned. They failed to find out who the real suppliers were as tempo continued to gain popularity. Along the way, the confusion leads to street violence and gang wars increased. Secrecy surrounding tempo keeps heat off the Olayas long enough for them to continue to expand. Soon, there are reports of overdoses and deaths, which prompt media coverage, but the public still remains largely ignorant of the epidemic brewing. By April, the original stock of tempo had decreased, causing the prices to skyrocket. The Olaya cartel's allies are also starting to be connected to the rise of tempo, leading to large-scale gang wars in Hong Kong and Seattle. A few dedicated anti-drug task forces began to connect the dots to the ghost cartels, but the police began to experience the downside of tempo addiction. In May, the drug war in Hong Kong puts the various triad syndicates against each other, while the Black Chrysanthemums war with the Smoke Circle triads. Hong Kong's underworld violence spills out onto the streets, and a protracted bloody conflict begins. Back in Seattle, Lone Star is coming to grips with their inability to get a handle on the burgeoning tempo crisis. As a result, they hire Seattle Metroplex Guard to help reinforce their officers. In June, the First Nations and the Ragers battle it out over tempo at the Seattle docks, killing 6 gang members and 4 others. One of those others is a Shadowrunner and Jackpoint member named Fatima. On the other side of the Pacific, a much deadlier event was taking place. In Kowloon, a massive gang war took place over who would control the flow of tempo in Hong Kong. Over 5,000 are killed in the massacre. Around this time, corporations began to take earnest notice of tempo, as many of their employees have become addicted to it and are showing erratic behavior. Among those getting most worried are the ghost cartels themselves, who did not adequately account for the negative side effects and the large notoriety it would draw from their enemies. Moving into summer, the deaths due to tempo increased beyond the poor and undesirable elements in society. As a result, other syndicates, law enforcement, and especially as technology, began to pour efforts into discovering the source of tempo. On July 16th, the worst gang violence in decades prompts Seattle Governor Kenneth Brackhaven to announce his wishes to reassure citizens that he is committed to dealing with the crisis. Far south of Seattle, the border between Amazonia and Aztlan becomes an area of ever-increasing hostility. Aztlan claimed to be cracking down on drug activity, with no irony of course, and had been using the opportunity to make attacks on Amazonian soil. By September, the tempo crisis had gone far beyond simple drugs and was alarming the highest level of government and corporate leadership. Starting in the east and moving west, governments and corps begin enacting laws and cracking down on tempo use and possession. Public figures come under increased scrutiny for their perceived lack of ability in handling the crisis thus far. In early September, the ghost cartels are set to hold a summit in LA to address their growing concerns. The 4 major cartels all send representatives. Unfortunately for them, as technology got wind of the meeting and 14 members of the cartel were killed, the Olaya cartel leader, Graciela Riveros, escaped using mysterious means, but the unity within the ghost cartels was flailing. In mid-September, Interpol issues an orange alert and suggests that tempo is from a single source in South America. While all of the tempo-driven insanity is going on, as technology was playing a different game. While yes, they cared about tempo, they cared more about expanding their territory and seeing how far they could push Amazonia. As such, the Aztecs used the tempo crisis to their advantage. As technology received permission from the corporate court and Interpol for a bombing campaign against Bogota to destroy tempo facilities. Of course, that wasn't all they did. In addition to the drug labs, as technology began striking at political enemies, including some within the government of Bogota. The National Capitol building in Bogota was destroyed, and the government collapsed. It's clear to me now that the Aztecs must have been bribing members of the corporate court and Interpol to allow this, especially since Aztechnology's interest in Bogota was so convenient to their political aims. But that isn't anything new. This was the event that set the stage for the Amazonia-Aztlan War, but that'll keep for next time. By September, the Olaya cartel had lost the support of the other ghost cartels. That didn't mean that they weren't still making money hand over fist. With no support, as technology saw another opportunity, they once again lobbied the corporate court to authorize strikes, this time with a full military operation targeting the Olaya cartel in South America. The court is favorable, but Amazonia was having none of it. They warned everyone sternly about the consequences of such an action. The result is an exploitation of shadow work and spy games. It was around this time that Alf Haben led Black Star into the action in Bogota to fight the Azzi aggression. In November, Aztlan accuses Amazonia of knowingly hiding drug lords, which Amazonia denies. The Azzis have a better propaganda machine and finally get the authorization for military strikes they'd been after. They raid the cartel assets in South America, including many in Amazonia, Bogota, and Caracas. Graciela Riveros and her Olaya cartel are destroyed, and the entire world sees Aztechnology as the heroes who saved them from Tempo. The mysterious faction that supplied Tempo to the ghost cartels, known as Primavera Vaga, led by a cabal of spirits, remained at large and not ever implicated in the crisis. The kicker is, Aztechnology didn't stop there. They won a PR battle against the Amazonians and started a new war. Further, if you need any proof that Aztechnology wasn't on the level, they still sell Tempo in their state-funded pharmacies. By November of 2071, however, the Tempo supply was at an all-time low, but demand was still soaring. Birth defects due to Tempo were increasing, and one of the lasting results of the Tempo Wars is that the Kumon Go Triad, the First Nations Gang, and the Dogmen formed an official alliance, giving them distribution and assets to become much bigger than they were, and allowing them to push west into Nan territory. The thing most people never realized about Tempo was just how insidious it really was. The awakened component of the drug didn't come from a tree, like the cartel suggested. Rather, it came from a shadow spirit inhabiting the tree, giving it a regenerative power to allow for unlimited harvesting. The resulting bark, when processed into a drug, yielded Tempo, and when enough of the drug was in a victim's system, it forced the addict into an unwilling spirit pact with a free shadow spirit, which allowed the spirit to take control of the host whenever they were asleep or unconscious. This is likely what the corpse found out, which spurred them into willingness to address the drug crisis. Shockingly, there were other events in 2071 that did not have to do with Tempo. 2071 saw Chicago's population increase for the first time since 2055. Things had been so bad for so long, there was nowhere to go but up. That and Chicagoans finally became as hard as they needed to be to survive. This was the start of a very nice time for me in Chicago. That's when I met the Songs and started cleaning up the neighborhood around Samson's Noodles. Me and the gangs worked out an understanding, and the Songs let me stay up in their building. The Technomancer witch hunts from 2070 continued, but laws were developing to address the issue. In early January, the New European Economic Community, or the NEEC, began requiring mandatory testing and registration of Technomancers. Just a few weeks later, the corporate court voted down an accord with sweeping rules about artificial intelligences registering in their home countries. The court said it preferred to determine their status on a case-by-case basis. The rest of the world generally follows the NEEC, and the Technomancer registration becomes the norm. Starting in February, the corporate court's wing of Artificial Resource Management, or ARM, along with Pulsar's Undernet Alliance, begin to police rogue AIs in the hope of preventing an all-out battle between those in control of the Matrix and those in control of the rest of the world. The Pueblo Corporate Council began to offer limited citizenship and system ID numbers to AI in exchange for Matrix services offered to the PCC. Not long after, many other corps began to do the same. Also in February, a company called Sun Temple Agriculture plants all available land in Tenochtitlan with a product called cotton candy grass. This plant was engineered to absorb pollutants and trap them in the soil as sulfur and ammonia. Afterwards, Tenochtitlan pollution levels dropped for the first time in 70 years, and the people of Tenochtitlan saw beautiful fields of reddish gold lit up by the rays of the sun. As a result, Sun Temple Agriculture claimed the 20 million Nuyen prize left from President Dunkelzahn's will for anyone who could develop a plant hardy enough to flourish in smog-choked areas. Meanwhile, in Seattle, courts there affirmed the city's right to stop bus services to certain areas, which were of course the areas with the highest concentration of orcs and trolls. Protests turned violent, by which I mean the police instigated violence and blamed it on the protesters. The Washington Monument in D.C. was shut down for 6 weeks when the National Park Service brought in the APEP Consortium to help them deal with some sort of spirit infestation. My sources say Shadim. Of course, they denied everything, saying it was just a routine examination for routine reasons. There's nothing routine about Shadim, if you ask me. As it turns out, Tempo wasn't the only drug flowing that year. Flodstar confiscated almost 50 tons of Laos in Tarislar from an ancient safe house. On April 20th, the NEC employs economic sanctions against France for attacking SOC's corporate facilities in 2070. Of course, France refuses to tell them it was a spy operation on behalf of some prophecy, so they just deal with it. In May, Seattle's Fahrenheit killer claims a seventh victim. And is it just me, or does Seattle have the world's crown when it comes to the number of serial killers it generates? Across the pond in Britain, on June 23rd, a march began in the inner city of London and ended at Buckingham Palace. For almost a decade, the so-called Pendragon had been at the heart of a resistance movement formed against the Lord Protector's office and the New Druidic movement that had been using their power to stay in power and control the populace. The Lord Protector's office had manipulated and forced ever more power under the authority of himself, and England was upset. Various protest groups had arisen, but all of them united that night under one banner. Despite nearly 2 million people involved in the march, there was little to no violence, and it had everything to do with the Pendragon. Every time there was a crisis, he showed up to rally the people to hope and courage with rousing speeches and calls to action. The night of the march, Pendragon appeared for the last time, as he called for the people to claim power back from the Lord Protector. The Lord Protector sent troops out to disperse the crowd, but were stopped in their tracks when Queen Caroline walked out of the palace and stood beside the Pendragon. 2 weeks later, Parliament voted to dissolve the Lord Protector's office, and Lord Marshmont went into voluntary exile. Of course, the New Druidic movement didn't just simply go away, but the Pendragon did. On July 1st, the UN Initiative on Awakened Issues released their Sapience Report. This was a 4,600-page document released ahead of a vote on non-metahuman sapient rights. Of course, the backlash from humanist groups in the CAS and the UCAS were expected, but many moderate groups were concerned as well. In Shanxi, July saw a huge explosion near the tomb of Shi Huangti. The government reported that 600 terracotta statues were destroyed in the blast, and they blamed grave robbers. Of course, grave robbers don't usually make that much noise or go out of their way to destroy what's inside, but regardless, the site has been closed since. What really happened was that there was a dragon there called Fukonglong, who had long been sleeping beneath the terracotta soldiers. The explosion was Fukonglong breaking out and rejoining the world. This dragon isn't like the others, as far as I can tell. All reports have this dragon bringing gifts to the people of Shanxi and genuinely taking an interest in the everyday lives of small people. As with everything dragon-related, we'll see, but this was 8 years ago, and Fukonglong still seems okay with me. In Azatlan, Enrico Silva was once again elected president. And in Chirtirngira, Elven Peace Force troops opened fire on a group of civilians who got a little bit too close to Crater Lake. Footage of the event shows several hundred unarmed and sleepy-looking individuals moving like zombies and were gunned down without warning. Finally, on December 2nd, Empress Hitomi of Japan gave birth to the Crown Prince, Asaka Nashihito. December 2nd is declared a national holiday. And now for the corporate news of 2071. Speaking of Hitomi, the Empress announces a new vision for Shiawase in order to rebalance things. The Shinto influence on the board increases, mostly from inheriting stock from older shareholders who had passed away, but the bottom line is, Shiawase has mostly benefited from the changes made. Over in the UCAS, Damian Knight was playing his games. He had been developing a friendship with Clayton Wilson, the founder of Lone Star Security, who I know you're all very much aware of. As it turns out, since Roger Soaring Owl left Ares, Knight needed someone with Wilson's knowledge base to help him out. Wilson was installed as the head of Knight Errant, and seeing as how Knight Errant was created in order to compete with Lone Star, this was a brilliant piece of corporate maneuvering. And of course, for your favorite part, the culture of 2071. Christy Day released her album Rainy Day, Barry Manilow's Once More Over the Moon hits the charts, Concrete Dreams got back together for a reunion tour, which was awesome, even if they did do it just for the money. Shieldwall's greatest hits album, Never Forgive, Never Forget, The Best of Shieldwall, was released. The Wild Cards album, Death of a Samurai, my personal favorite offering of 2071. And Misuhama resurrected Shaw Brothers Studios, opening up facilities in Singapore and Hong Kong. And finally, the steampunk style comes back around as Shadowrunners and high society types alike begin to break out their leather and brass outfits once again. And before we end, I'll leave you with these little bits. 2071 was the last time anyone has claimed anything from Dunkelzon's will. That's when Morgan Leroy Hall claimed the stock portfolio that Dunkelzon left him. And finally, 2071 saw the discovery of a new type of infected metahuman called a Gnar. Gnars were discovered in the decrepit Cabrini Refuge in Chicago and are dwarfs infected with strain 2 HMHVV. Turns out they like metahuman bones instead of blood or flesh. Fortunately for you, I'm the one providing the blood and other body fluids so that you can waste an entirely good slot of time listening to the Neo-Anarchist Podcast. In closing, I want to give a hearty hello to our newest Patreon supporters, which receive monthly offerings of Neo-Anarchist Street gear. Freshly included in this illustrious list of capable crowfunders is Britt Thomas, Joshua Lang, Angela, Doc Falcon, Nelty Litzley, Ryder, Count Dracula, William Borth, and Jeremiah McCoy. Thank you all. Everything you need to set up and maintain Neo-Anarchist cells in your area, which includes new stickers every month, patches, pins, dice bags, fake sins, contact sheets for Opti and his crew, USB cred sticks, Black Star t-shirts, whiskey glasses, temporary tattoos, Black Star dog tags, and an upcoming album worth of Six World musical malarkey will be delivered to your safe house as we march bravely on. The music serving as the background to Audible Anarchy was written by the legend Marshall Parker and reimagined by Unanimium 88. This was the Neo-Anarchist Podcast, and I am your host, the Tell It True, Give Her a Clue, You Do You, Never a Mary Sue, You Can Come Too, Watch What I Do, Turn You to Goo, Turning a Screw, Unbroken Blue, Take My Cue, Room with a View, Shiny and New, host, Opti. Enjoy your freedom. A spirit hiding in your drugs might just take it from you.